Accession number 28678, Mr. Dermot Rhodes, Reel 15. Now, so what happens next then? You're busy coordinating all this. The ship's being built. You're looking after the men ashore, coordinating the work of the specialist commanders, liaising with the captain. What happens? You know, what's the next stage?
Well, gradually, as you get closer and closer towards the time when you're going to take the ship away and start naval training proper, you tend to get more and more people joining. So the number of people joining ship's company increases. So you've got to keep an eye on that. You've got to keep an eye on the training. And, of course, above all, you've got to get from the shipyard a date of leaving the yard. And you leave the yard. Then you go on sea trials and the ship...
Now, is there anything... Is there a handing over ceremony? I mean, what happens when you take over?
We haven't got that yet.
Oh, right, sorry.
Not quite.
So the sea trials come before. Sorry.
The sea trials come before, and they're quite extensive, bearing in mind.
Tell me what they are.
Well, the sea trials are the contractor's chance, or they have to demonstrate to the Ministry of Defence that the ship is what they're paying for, and it could do what they're paying for in terms of speed, manoeuvrability, habitability, and almost everything else, everything. And so you tend to get, you get quite a full crew, but when you go to sea that very first time, the ship still flies the red ensign of the Merchant Navy, still belongs to the shipbuilder, and the naval crew are either there observers, or some of them, particularly the technical engineers, have done training and work with shipbuilders, and they will be part of the steaming complement or the trials crew. But otherwise, it's full of shipbuilders and all sorts of strange women you didn't normally find on warships at sea, including cleaners and everything else. And then you go off and do a concentrated series of trials, as were up really around the west coast of Scotland, mainly machinery trials, anchoring, navigational, innumerable trials to make sure the ship performs to its expected capability.
Did it?
And that the taxpayer is getting the money it's paid for. Oh, yes, it did. Yeah, absolutely. And exceeded them in some places. We then concluded the sea trials by steaming down to Portsmouth, ready for the big handover. And when you'd done this, you did an audit, well, the shipbuilder and the Ministry of Defence. There's a whole team of specialist naval officers who used to work specifically on ships building, and they carried out this audit. And when all is ready, and then you have a little ceremony on board where the captain actually signs a little bit of paper saying, "I've assumed command, or I've taken over, or I accept HMS Invincible." The red ensign is lowered and the white ensign is hoisted, and then it's yours. And then you will have already have planned a huge program of more trials, and culminating in a big workup training period when.
Now, so the ship is sort of working up trials period.
Well, the initial trials, no, they're more sort of sea acceptance trials, and they're trials with. They're more the finer trials with equipment, like you then get more aircraft on board, you practice aircraft tracking, you get all your weapons sorted out and do a lot of weapons trials, some trials that we didn't do on straight contractor sea trials. And now during this time, sometime before you actually become fully operational, you have your big commissioning ceremony.
Now tell me about that, because you must have been... very involved in that. In fact, all
yes.
of that, I would imagine.
Yeah.
What tell us about the commission.
Well, the Queen launched the ship, and so she graciously accepted an invitation to commissioning, and actually commissioned the ship as well. And the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh came for the commissioning ceremony. And this is where every ship has a commissioning ceremony when it recommissions or recommissions. And you're given one of the best berths in the dockyard, not parked out somewhere at the back of beyond. And it's a formal ceremony, religious ceremony, which is a traditional type of ceremony, normally with three chaplains, an Anglican, a Catholic, and a sort of a nonconformist. I suppose now they would also have ethnic representatives as well. But you have the whole ship's company is on parade, and their families are invited, and guests, and you have a sort of parade inspection by the VIP, and then the VIP goes on board to have a look around the ship, and then we all have little receptions on board. So it's a day, really. With the Queen, it's quite something special because there's a fair amount of hard work to be done beforehand, working out the route, deciding what the Queen can or cannot do. Of course, going around a warship that size is quite, a physical problem. But the first thing we were told, don't worry, the Queen will go anywhere you want her to go. So that was a relief. And of course, the Duke of Edinburgh, likewise. But the funny thing about this is that we'd planned after the ceremony, because this was a brand new ship, nobody had ever seen the like of it before, we would take both the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh on guided tours. But to take them together, of course, Duke of Edinburgh with his interest in ships and things, and the Queen with perhaps not quite so interested in the technicalities, we decided that the captain would take the Queen around the ship and I would take the Duke of Edinburgh. And we'd take opposing routes, and we would all meet. The Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh would get together on the quarterdeck just before the main reception with the officers. And we did this. So I took the Duke of Edinburgh round, and my goodness, I had to keep on my toes. He was very, very sharp. Very sharp. But the amusing thing happened at the end of the tour. I'd been watching the clock like a hawk to make sure we got back on time, and we got back on time and sort of hung around for a couple of minutes, and he said, what are we waiting for? I said, well, we're waiting for Her Majesty, sir. He said, I'm always bloody well waiting for Her Majesty. So that made me smile. I don't know whether I laughed at the time, but it was an obviously a heartfelt remark. And then the Queen came, she chatted to the families and wives, girlfriends, and anybody else in the way that only the Queen can do. And so did the Duke, wandering around. Had lunch on board. Met more families afterwards, and then they went.
Do you know the date of the commissioning ceremony?
I can't remember.
Okay.
So I should have looked it up before.
Doesn't matter. So what happens next? So you've been commissioned.
So next, the really hard work starts then. And you...
So this is the working up trials, is it?
We're coming up now to the working up trials. Having done your acceptance trials, sea acceptance trials, you then go into the work up proper. And that, for us, was based at Portland. And it took, 7 weeks, I think? 7 weeks.
Now, what do you remember of the working up trials?
Well, the work up, Portland work ups were notorious, whatever ship you're in, for being times when you're absolutely flat out and you haven't got time really to sit and think, and it really is concentrated, nose to the grindstone stuff. However, we knew that the Portland staff didn't know our ship. They knew the principles on which we had to operate, but they did not know our ship. Now, they came around beforehand and looked around a couple of times, but they hadn't been living on board for several weeks like we had, several months. And so we thought we might be a sort of bit of a jump ahead. And so it turned out, but not entirely, because they were pretty sharp cookies, these guys. They were all extremely experienced in their own particular field. So the work-up staff were extremely experienced and good at their job. In fact, very soon picked up the layout of the ship, and we had some very fruitful, productive, and very tough training, hard work.
What kind of things?
You start off, of course, with fairly basic things like simple manoeuvring, a lot of safety drills, picking up men overboard, flying, a lot of flying safety drills, and then you gradually progress through. You normally have a week at sea training, and then a week in harbour doing harbour training, which are various courses and drills, and then a week or two, I think, at sea, doing progressively advanced more exercises, anti-submarine, anti-air, weapon firing, boats, and then you do a week in harbour where you do advanced training, aid to civil power. There was a disaster area, and you have to deal with floods, earthquakes, revolutions, a whole looters, a whole raft of the sort of thing you might have to deal with anywhere in the world. And then the final week is with advanced exercises, and you do a period of exercises, two or three, where you're subject to real air threats, and you get aircraft, attacking aircraft screaming in, submarines after you, surface other ships after you. You work with other ships, because we also train NATO navies, particularly the Dutch and the Germans come up there for training. So at the end of all this, you're produced then, you're assessed, and you're given assessment. And we were assessed as being satisfactory then in terms of operational ability to join the fleet.
And where are we going to join them? Where would you be based?
We're based in Portsmouth.
And was this, you joining the home fleet or just the fleet? I mean, did you actually join the home fleet or...?
Well, I think the home fleet was defunct by then. It was the fleet. The fleet with a capital F. Under Commander-in-Chief Fleet, who was based at Northwood. No. Then after that, in fact, we did a series of trials which we didn't do before. We did a number of trials which we hadn't done before our workup, which were specialist advanced trials. One of which was a healing trial up in some Scottish loch. I can't even remember the name of the loch, but it was a remote loch. And we were secure between six buoys there. And the ship was, stores were shifted, tanks were pumped, heeled over to certain degrees to see what effect it might have on various other pieces of equipment. Whilst this was going on, over it was over a period, I suppose, of about 4 or 5 days, the captain went off to pay a visit to our adopted city, which was actually the city of Durham. So he went off there to dine with the mayor and enjoy himself. I was left on board. And while he was away, a gale blew up. And fortunately, got the navigating officer on board with me. He came to tell me one afternoon, shortly after this had started, he was concerned that the fact that the ship was being, the buoys were being dragged. And so there I had visions of this brand new aircraft carrier being put on the beach in a Scottish loch, and the captain was whooping it up with the mayor of Durham. Anyway, the routine. So we sent for a tug, two tugs from Baslane, and they came. And for 12 hours, these tugs held us on the berth, much against their will, because they were there all night with this wind blowing. So it was quite an interesting and busy time. And of course, by the time the captain got back, it was flat calm, and you wouldn't think of anything had happened. And that was one interesting aspect.
Any other advanced trials you remember?
yes, I'm just trying to. There was one other important one. Which has just slipped my memory last time. I remembered it 2 minutes ago. And I've forgotten.
Never mind, we'll perhaps come back to it.
Oh, I know what it was. Cold weather trials. We went back up to North Norway in the ice and snow and everything else, and operated everything with, you know, in sub-zero temperatures, with ice and snow and goodness knows what else littering the deck. And that was quite picturesque and interesting, if slightly uncomfortable. We took a whole load of Royal Marines up with us, because that's where they operate as well, for them also to get familiar with our ship, because we were dual role. We could have taken them up. We had extra mess decks for fleet air arm people. And also then, great excitement, we embarked our squadrons. That's the Harriers. We'd been operating with them ashore before that. and we did a flying workup. That was, we got our Harrier squadron, and
which was that? Do you remember the number?
That was 800 squadron.
And what else?
And then we got a helicopter seeking squadron, which was 820. And everybody had said to him, of course, the commander was president of the wardroom mess, and the so we had lots of spare space, and I was in charge of the officer's wardroom, if you like. The captain was not a member of our mess. He did his own thing in his own quarters. But everybody was saying, oh, you know, it's all right, these guys, wait till the fleet, the air crew join. You know, the Harrier pilots and the seeking pilots and reservers, you won't know what's hit you. So it was a certain amount of trepidation these guys came on board, and they were wonderful, absolutely wonderful. Very, very professional, first-rate aviators, very competitive, loved their fun, liked doing. But you, if you talk to them the right way, or got on the right side of the squadron CO, they were fine. And I always thoroughly enjoyed them, admired their professionalism, flew with them in their helicopters quite often. So we did quite a lot of flying and flying trials. And one of the helicopter squadron solitaires was the Duke of York. He was a squadron, junior squadron pilot for quite some time when I was there.
Do you think, I mean, he was pretty junior, but on the other hand, he's well known. What did you think of him?
He was a very good helicopter pilot, there's no doubt about that, and he was highly thought of. He was quite a quiet lad, really, and I mean, you can understand that the load that he was operating under. He lived in a cabin just the same as anybody else. He had his minder, his special branch chap, who's next door to him in a cabin, who at sea didn't do anything. I mean, certainly on board the ship, he was under the Naval Discipline Act, and responsible through his squadron CO to me for whatever went on. We tended to find that when the ship got in harbour, he would disappear for various functions and things, but he always had to, tell me when he was going and when he came back, so he'd always come and report to me. And he was always assiduous, good at doing that. He was not a hellraiser on board. He was very abstemious, sober, interesting young lad, like any young, very junior naval officer should be, seen and not heard very much.
Now, what happened next then? You've got your aircraft aboard, you've got your helicopters aboard, then you're flying. What were the flying trials? I should perhaps have asked more.
The flying trials mainly revolved around the Harrier, which again was a brand new aircraft. So, I mean, there was this thing which looked very odd. There was this jet fighter sitting alongside the bridge about 50 feet off the deck, motionless, very strange performance. And so most of our flying trials then were to do with Harrier operations. And they went extremely well. Sad, we did lose one Harrier. At one time, just we got a BBC team on board, who were very good, and who didn't say anything actually.
So what happened?
We got the pilot. It was an engine failure. Sorry.
How did it happen? What happened?
It was an engine failure, and with an aircraft like that at fairly low level, what it was, you don't wait to see what had happened. You get out as soon as the alarm bells are ringing. And we picked the pilot up. The helicopters were rather less occupied in trials, more actually keeping training in their mainly anti-submarine role, ducking sonars and things like that. And we did our trials. We also went on a series of visits, mainly to one in the States to show the Americans this extraordinary ship. And we went to one of their main bases in Florida, to Jacksonville in Florida, and sat alongside the jetty in this enormous dockyard with about five other huge aircraft carriers, but none of them could do what we did. And we flew a Harrier off in harbour. These guys didn't know what had hit them. And we had a very, very happy few weeks there, and we we were going to go to, we were scheduled to go to Boston, but sadly the security people wouldn't let us go there because of the Irish influence at the time and the IRA threat. So we never got to Boston. So it was a fairly limited trip, really. We went to do noise-ranging trials in Norway, and this was...
Well, what's that about?
Well, this was to check, all ships do it, and you have to redo it, but they advance the top ranges in Norway, it's a series of hydrophones on the bottom of the ocean, and you go pass over the top of them, and they measure and paint a picture of your noise signature, in other words, the sort of noises are transmitted. And you do a series of runs over them with your engines and certain bits of machinery operating, certain parts of machinery not operating, and so you get a picture built up of how noisy the ship is, because of course a number of underwater weapons that might be arranged against you or underwater detection devices actually pick up the noise you make. So that was another trial we did. We went down to the Mediterranean and based in Gibraltar and did some trials down there.
What time trials?
Well, this was more sort of warmer weather type of trials and general sort of deep water trials. We did them off the Gibraltar Straits going out into the Atlantic.
Anything about them? Or
I can't remember anything specific, except they were a bit boring, I think. A lot, of course, what goes in a big ship like that, a lot of what the ship is doing is a mystery to a lot of people, unless they make it their business to find out. And even then, even the likes of myself, I mean, there were things that were going on the technical side that I didn't even understand, never mind. I knew what they were for, and I knew roughly what they were doing. I knew what the ship's requirement was, but I left it to them.
So what happened next, after Gibraltar?
This was quite a long time. It was going on. It must have been 78, this. 80. 80, 81. We then went up to... we came back and we did a thing called a JMC, a Joint Maritime Course. Now, this was operating out of Rosyth. There was an establishment located at RAF Turnhouse in Edinburgh, which was known as the Joint Maritime Tactical Training Centre. It was under joint direction of the RAF and the Navy. There was a naval captain running the naval side and a group captain running the RAF side. But it provided advanced maritime warfare training for NATO forces. And it used to run so many courses a year, about three a year, I think. And anything up to 30 or 40 ships would gather there and then go off onto the North Sea and the Northern Approaches to do advanced anti-submarine, anti-air type of exercises. And we went up there to do one of these exercises. And whilst we were there, we had a visit from the Royal Australian Naval Attaché, a captain, because rumour had come round that the Invincible was going to be sold to the Australian Navy. I think by that time Sir John Knott had come to power and was busy getting rid of ships right, left and centre. And so this was a very strange and slightly strained meeting. Here's this brand new ship that we'd all put together and got to a high state of efficiency. We were incredibly proud of it. And here were the Australians about to buy it. In the event, and as future events transpired, we shall see why. It never actually happened, but it was certainly very much on the cards. And I think in the end, the Australians found it was a bit too big and too advanced for them, too expensive to operate.
Why did was this was it who's it. Who was behind this? Was it Sir John Knott? He's a defence secretary, was he?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. In his earlier days.
And what did you... So you were very much against this?
Oh, we, of course, crew. We couldn't believe they would want to get rid of this brand new ship, first of a class. But the decision, final decision, was sometime in the future after this particular visit from the Australian Naval Attaché, who was, I think, coming in and having a preliminary look around. After that, we operated in home waters for a while, and we had some interesting visitors. We had the Archbishop of Canterbury on board for a few days with his sidekick, Terry Waite. Now, this was before the days that Terry Waite was locked up in Beirut or wherever he was for his 5 years, but it was Robert Runcie was the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, I'd seen and heard the Archbishop, I'd seen him on television and heard him on the radio, and really hadn't registered all that much, although he'd been a tank commander during the war and won the MC. I mean, he was certainly all about on the services. His sort of persona on television and radio wasn't all that brilliant, but he came on board. And my goodness, what a different chap he was. Charismatic, very amusing, quite dry, could talk to the sailors. He did a confirmation service on board. But the other revelation was Terry Waite, who was a big man, I don't know, 6.5 feet or something like that, and built like it. And I remember taking him down to the chief's mess, chief petty officer's mess. And he went in there, and they said, "What would you like to drink?" And he said, "Oh, well," he said, "I'm in with the Navy, so I'd better have some rum." Now, I knew that they'd given him, they'd saved some of their special Navy rum for him, and it was very strong. And they gave him a very good measure of this, and he put it down in no time. And so, typical naval hospitality, they refilled it. And he had another one. And he was halfway down his third, and I thought, I've got to get this guy out of here, but he'll never get out. But he was chatting away quite happily, talking to them. And the next visit was to the wardroom for drinks before dinner. And we got up to the wardroom, and I said, what will you have to drink? And he said, I'm in the wardroom. You all drink gin here, I better have gin. And a couple of gins later, he was still. I've never seen, the man had hollow legs. I've never seen anybody drink as he did throughout dinner, without dropping a stitch, without hesitating, faltering, or anything. A very amusing raconteur, very amusing fellow. I never did quite work out what he did, the Archbishop of Canterbury. But I thought, you know, it's useful having a guy like that around. So that was an interesting trip. We had a number. We had the moderator of the Church of Scotland, as many admirals, foreign and our own, as you could shake a stick at. It became slight chore at times. Until one day when we were in Portsmouth about to go to sea for more trials, 3 or 4 days, and we got a call saying, the Prince of Wales would like to come to sea with you. Now, this was the time when things were hotting up and the marriage stakes. And it was just before he proposed to Diana. And he came to us, really, to keep the press off his back a bit, to give him a bit of a respite. And so he spent the weekend with us. I'd never met him before. I must say, I was very impressed with the guy. He sometimes gets a bad press. But he, again, I took him down to the chief's mess, and they're a hard bunch, great, great guys with that, but he had them in his palm of his hand within minutes. Extremely good with sailors, talking, fascinating, interested, and a very, very welcome guest. And I hope he enjoyed his time aboard anyway.